Growing up in Western Pennsylvania and living here as an adult, I've come into contact with white-tailed deer more times than I could count. There were deer antlers displayed in my childhood home, and even though I live in a city now, I see deer almost every day in my or a neighbor's yard because our homes are adjacent to a big cemetery, basically a park. So I thought I knew deer until I read Erica Hauser's new book, The Age of Deer. Hauser also grew up in Pennsylvania. She lives in rural Virginia now, but she traveled as far as England, Texas, and New Jersey to investigate our relationship with these animals that so commonly live among us. She visited an enclosed hunting park, studied cave art, and even learned to tan a deer hide. I had a chance to talk with Hauser about her book recently. What are some of the old myths and stories about deer that we still live with today?
Well, there is a pretty rich body of mythology and tales about deer. There are some really fascinating ones that have deer and humans shape-shifting into each other. There are a lot of stories about deer that kind of lead someone on a quest. So the deer will appear usually to a hunter, and of course the hunter starts pursuing the deer and ends up in a new world or a new life. You know, there's a beautiful story from the Inglacotma people of Washington State and British Columbia that has a human hunter essentially marrying a deer woman and becoming part of this clan of sort of human deer beings that keep shape-shifting in and out of deer and human form. But I would say the stories we're still living with the most today would be the ones where deer are victims. So where they, you know, they turn into victims of hunters or victims of misfortune. And I think that really informs a big part, certainly not all, but a big part of the way we look at them in our kind of contemporary world.
Yeah, victims of our cars and vehicles. Mm-hmm. That's a big section of your book. You write that many people today would say there are too many deer now for the way that we live our lives, and that many of us hold on to an outdated ecological belief about the balance of nature, this idea that left to its own devices, there's a natural balance of plants and animals, and that includes deer populations. But there really aren't any humans in that equation. So how does that line of thinking contribute to how we think about what the right number of deer is?
Well, we do have a tendency to start saying that there are too many whenever they are making life a little bit inconvenient for us. So as you mentioned, you know, vehicle collisions is a really common problem. And also, of course, landscaping damage to gardens and farmers' crops. That's a big reason that people get annoyed with them. And then Lyme disease is also on that list. But, you know, those are all cultural factors. So that's part of what we call cultural carrying capacity, which is how many deer people will tolerate. There's a totally different measurement called biological carrying capacity, which would be how many deer a habitat can sustain. So they're two very different numbers, and the biological carrying capacity tends to be higher than the number that people will easily tolerate. And the more you're talking about deer in a suburban or urban space where there are lots of people and lots of roads and cars and buildings, the harder it is to say what that biological carrying capacity might be. But really, in any environment, there's some scientific disagreement about how many deer is the right number for a habitat. And when you don't have any large predators, which is true throughout most of the eastern U.S., it just becomes really hard to pin that down. And a lot of communities do end up feeling like they have too many and they need to do something about their deer population and get them under control. And it's just really striking sometimes what the language is around that. For example, on Staten Island in New York, there's been an ongoing program to perform vasectomies on the male deer on the island, and it's about to wrap up. It's been going on for almost 8 years, and it's been the city considers it to be a success because they have reduced the number of deer, they've reduced the birth rate, and they've reduced the number of car crashes involving deer. But when you look at the absolute numbers, you're talking about something like 1,500 deer on an island that is also home to 500,000 people. So there's just something really fascinating to me about how humans claim the space. And, you know, we look at ourselves in numbers like 500,000, and then we look at an animal of which there's 1,500, and we say the problem here is there's too many of that animal.
Hmm. You might know in Pittsburgh, where I live, they've started a pilot deer program in a couple of city parks.
Mm-hmm.
That's a bow hunting program. You traveled to Princeton, New Jersey, where they have this well-established, really professional program, and you kind of looked at the butchering process afterwards and how these deer were processed. And I have to confess, it felt a little gruesome to me. And I was reading it, I felt really uncomfortable. But you know, as you point out, somebody's doing these jobs. Throughout the book, you follow a lot of lines of inquiry in your reporting that seem to make you uncomfortable. Maybe not that scene exactly, but can you say a little bit about some of those roads that you traveled and why?
Well, the Princeton trip definitely was one of those. I don't necessarily think it's comfortable for the people who do it either. You know, there's nothing easy about the killing of animals or the processing of their bodies. Though I will say, you know, watching the butcher do his work was, you know, I'd spent the previous evening watching those carcasses being collected from the people who were doing the shooting. And the butchering process was kind of therapeutic in a way, because I was seeing that these animals that had been, you know, less than 24 hours ago walking around living their lives, then I had seen them as bodies, and then seeing those bodies being transformed into meat that was going to go to a food bank and become food for people who need food. That was, you know, if there's any kind of redeeming thing about this situation, it's that. So I was glad that I got to see that. And I knew in general that I needed to observe some aspect of that culling process in some location, because it's a common widespread thing that happens all over the country. And it's a big part of our human relationship to deer. And that's really what I was trying to investigate, was that relationship more than the deer themselves. It's, you know, how we relate to them.
You grew up in Western Pennsylvania, but hadn't been deer hunting until you went with your brother and then joined some other family members in Punxsutawney on a hunt. And you write about how that experience changed you. Would you read a little section about that?
Sure. I began learning how to keep my footsteps quiet, to roll each foot along the outside edge, to step on rocks and avoid the twigs. I had always seen deer so often, so easily, that they felt like a given. Now I had crossed some strange line. It wasn't looking at, but looking for. I had become a seeker of deer, a wanderer and quester, glad for every track, every nibbled stem. Hearing a snort, then some resonant hoofbeats through the tangled vines, and knowing I'd just pushed a deer forward with the noise of my own footsteps, a line of sound connecting us forward and back. Putting my finger carefully on the little ridge of soil running down the middle of a hoofprint, touching the ends of chewed saplings frayed by deer's teeth.
So, yeah, I'm just curious about that sort of change in you and how you experience your relationship with deer.
Well, I would say that did somewhat come out of hunting, but it also just came out of, in general, a greater appreciation for deer that developed in me as a result of the research, and especially learning about how close we came to wiping them out in the early 20th century. I developed a sort of gratitude for the fact that they're here, and they're here in numbers, and we do get to see them in our daily lives. And near the end of the writing process, I was talking to someone I know, and I kind of described the project to her, and she said, "Oh, so are you hanging out with the deer then?" And I thought, no, I guess I haven't really been hanging out with the deer. I've been reading about deer a ton and kind of talking to all these people and going to these places, you know, where people have some professional connection to deer, but actually just hanging out with the deer, no, I haven't been doing that enough. So I started to do more of that. And I realized that there is this kind of hunter's way of going out into a space and hoping to see them. So it's not just passively, you know, happening to see them, but you're trying to make it happen. And how much that changes your way of moving and your mindset. It becomes very, very exciting to see any little sign of them. So that was pretty neat for me to experience that change.
Deer have occupied a place in the human experience and imagination for millennia. What can we learn from deer now in the time that we're living in?
One of the kind of watchwords or, you know, key phrases for me in the writing process was life among the ruins. That applies to deer in many ways, but especially in the sense that they are able to thrive in densely populated, you know, human places in cities and suburbs. And they're just, especially white-tailed deer, are just so good at adaptation and learning their way around the obstacles that people have put in their way. And, you know, I think we're all living among the ruins in some sense right now. We're living in a time of climate crisis and all kinds of environmental degradation, and we have to make our way amongst those things. I was recently in Pittsburgh and took a walk around a part of the city where the amount of kind of trash and litter was really, really extreme, I would say. There was just a lot of, you know, we were walking through a little patch of woods and there was so much broken glass in those woods. And there were also lots of deer trails. And we saw a deer in somebody's yard at the end of the walk. And I thought, that's just so emblematic of how they are. You know, it's just, I'm still amazed by the sort of miraculous fact that a large mammal can live, thrive, reproduce, find enough to eat in those kinds of environments. And that's true all over the place, not just in Pittsburgh. So I sort of look at them as heroes of adaptation. And I think, you know, our task certainly as people is to adapt to the situation that we've made, the situation that we're in, of course, try to make things better, but to learn how to live with what's here now. And deer are really good at that.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
Erica Hauser is the author of The Age of Deer, Trouble and Kinship with Our Wild Neighbors. She's also a poet, and you can find links to her work at our website, alleghenyfront.org.